KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass. And KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We're in this time where the issues we face are so desperately important in terms of literal existence that now I have sort of pivoted from, you know, having done a lot of work against the fracking industry and coal mining, to saying my job is to now keep queer youth alive. That feels like that shouldn't have to be anyone's job. Queer youth should be growing up in a world that's rich and varied and shows them the magicalness of growing into adulthood. But we are in it right now with libraries being censored, with anti-trans legislation sweeping the country. It's sort of like, look over here at this shiny thing while my left hand does the destroying of other things that are desperately important to life.
In this episode, acclaimed author and queer activist Taylor Broerby conjures dreams of belonging. In his journey to reconcile nature and culture, he's forced to choose between his defense of nature and the protection of queer communities and rights. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Staying Alive, Reconciling Nature, Culture, and Gay Rights. Psychologists have a term for a phenomenon they call an extinction burst. It manifests as a sudden spike in the frequency and intensity of a behavior when the reinforcement for that behavior is removed. Think of a child throwing a tantrum when a parent withholds screen time until homework is done. Usually, the behavior gets dramatically worse before it gets better, until eventually, without the positive reinforcement, the behavior becomes extinct. Today, as human-induced climate disruption is ravaging the world, the fossil fuel industry has doubled down on what you might call an extinction burst, because it knows the civilizational shift off fossil fuels is accelerating rapidly. Simultaneously, epic social transformations are similarly producing cultural extinction bursts. One of those is the savage backlash against LGBTQ people. It comes at exactly the moment when a record 84% of non-LGBTQ Americans support equal rights for the LGBTQ community. A 96% supermajority agree that LGBTQ people should have the freedom to live their life and not be discriminated against. A 91% supermajority says schools should be a safe and accepting place for all youth. Writer and activist Taylor Broerby, who comes from generations of fossil fuel workers, has worked at the bleeding edges of both of these movements, and he believes they're related. He spoke on a panel at a Bioneers conference.
I come from the least visited state in the country, North Dakota, so if you haven't been there recently, let me bring you in hot to what's happening, because it's the testing ground for the country's worst ideas, but I swear I've got some light I'm going to bring to you all. But I grew up with the Badlands as my backbone and the Missouri River as the main artery of my life. And as you all know, I don't need to tell this crowd what the Trevor Project reports about suicidal ideation in our various communities. 45% of queer youth last year had suicidal ideation. That number is higher amongst BIPOC queer youth. That number is the highest amongst the transgender community, somewhere around 69% of what's being reported. Just the other day, my home state set the record by passing 10 anti-queer laws into being. a lot of work to do. You all know that. I went home 2 weeks ago. I had my nails painted for the first time in 30 years. The last time was by Grandma Brorby, who was a fierce little woman who looked cute on the outside, but she'd cut you if you screwed up. And so it was great to go back home. I had my nails painted in transgender colors as a nice little middle finger to the state legislature of North Dakota, which continues to make my work possible.
But Taylor Brorby's journey into activism did not begin with gay rights. It grew out of his deep connection to his beloved homeland, the landscapes of North Dakota that have suffered long-term destruction by extractive industries. He chronicled his journey in his widely praised book, Boys and Oil, Growing Up Gay in a Fractured Land.
But I grew up in a landscape where I was gaslit by all the adults I grew up around, because if you haven't heard, every lake in North Dakota is supposed to freeze, but I grew up swimming in a lake that never freezes in North Dakota. You can sit in it in January and it's bathtub warm with your stocking cap on, because its water is used to cool the coal-fired turbine engines of the power plant where my mother worked the entirety of her career, that was fed coal from the mine where my grandpa Brorby spent the entirety of his career. So the scary history of North Dakota, of course, begins with the genocide of Native Americans. And that, of course, wasn't enough, because we needed hydroelectric power in the state. So we dammed the Missouri River in intentional ways to flood sacred agricultural land. In the eastern part of North Dakota, we're growing one crop that most people love, sugar. In the south central part of North Dakota, where I come from, we strip the land of coal. To the west, we have hydraulic fracking. The northern third tier of the state had it seceded in the 1950s during the Cold War. It would have been the third most powerful nuclear nation on the planet. My home power plant, where my mother worked, what paid for my saxophone lessons, is now the world's test site for carbon capture and storage, where we're going to liquefy carbon dioxide emissions and pump them 6,000 feet underground, where it will stay forever. And this will impact every state from Maine to where we are in California by unleashing a pipeline revolution. So when these 48-inch in diameter chrome pipelines break, as we know all pipelines do, I got arrested over one called the Dakota Access Pipeline in Iowa. And thanks. It's sometimes nice to bite the hand that fed you, you know. But when these pipelines break, and if there's wind, then you get a thing called a carbonic acid cloud, which prevents engines from operating. EMTs are not coming to help you. These pipelines will traverse the entirety of the continent, sending this liquid product to my home to be shoved back down 6,000 feet under the Earth's surface, which is also the level where we're fracking in North Dakota, too. Somehow, in that rural little landscape, four generations of fossil fuel people produced a very gay, crunchy granola environmentalist here. And so anything's possible. You can go to the moon if you grow up gay in North Dakota.
As a young person, if Taylor Brorby felt the grown-ups gaslit him about the flagrant environmental destruction all around him, being gay was also taboo.
If you haven't heard, just to bring you on the harbor tour of North Dakota and its worst ideas, and then we're going to get in, because I fall into that 45% of queer youth. Maybe some of you in this room do. And what's such a pleasure for me is I grew up in a tiny town of 600, going to school with the same 22 other students, 16 boys and 6 other girls. So even if you were unfortunately straight, the dating options were limited in my class. But what's been so nice and surreal for me is that I never thought I would be standing in front of you publicly talking about being gay, because I worked so hard to try to hide that very real part of who I was. And my big sister, if she were here, even when I lower my voice, my sister goes, "You sound like a drag queen who's been smoking for 20 years." So even when I'm back in North Dakota, I'm like, hi, how are you? It's like, as the day is long, you know.
That sense of vanishing isolation is part of what moved Taylor Broerby to write Boys in Oil. He spoke with us at a Bioneers conference.
So if you follow the 100th meridian, which divides the country from the arid west and the water-rich east, where you don't need to irrigate, for instance, to do agriculture, it runs through North Dakota. If you follow that line from North Dakota, Texas, then over to where I currently live in Salt Lake and up to Seattle, you'll get something like a 15-state region, and there is no memoir about growing up gay in that region. There now is at least one, my book, and I hope a large number follow, because what I worry about, if you grow up without even a story that says you're not alone, how do you know you're not a freak? Or that, well, no one like me lives here. You know, when I was writing my book, I was imagining this tiny town no one's been to in Montana called Brodus, Montana. And I thought, there's some gay boy there who needs to be able to go to a library and pull off a book. I get quite emotional about this because I was that kid. There was no book that reflected who I was okay. And queer youth experienced such a high rate of suicidal ideation. And I wanted to write a true book where the gay kid stays alive. I mean, that's how low the bar is in America right now for people like me. We're being legislated against, and I just wanted a book to be out there that showed a life and a life that kept going.
Taylor says that when he was growing up, there was a default assumption that everyone was straight. Being gay in a place where supposedly no one was gay marked a harrowing descent into invisibility and self-denial. It also became a survival exercise to dream his way out of a nightmare, to imagine a different way of being and belonging. Once again, the landscape was there to hold him.
It's a lonely existence. You know, a few years ago, I had some Facebook post where a guy I grew up with had said, oh, I thought you were so happy. We were so happy as children. You seem to be so happy. And I think what's so heartbreaking about that is a lot of queer youth, I imagine, depending on where they're growing up, they're acting to just try to, you know, get by or fit in or say, get me to high school and to graduation, and then I can go someplace else where it might be a little easier for me. And so there's a certain loneliness there. And so my babysitters became like the Square Butte Creek, you know, or like the fish I would go fishing for with the beavers and things like this, because I get emotional thinking about it. But, you know, who I was growing up was very difficult for other people to handle just because of interest, because they didn't quite compute. I wanted to take painting classes, or actually cared about piano. And I was grateful I grew up in a landscape that was big enough to hold what I felt, you know, because no one where I grew up went to therapy. There's not a therapist in the town. And so my therapy was wandering the hills and going fishing and doing that, which is some solace, I guess.
The solace of the ancient majesty and riotous diversity of the landscape nourished Taylor's imagination and his soul. Yet at the same time, the burdens of history lived heavy in the land. The ghosts of generations of settlers, whose child he was, haunted him with a psychological disconnect.
It was such an incredible place to grow up, especially as I aged, because I realized my very county seems to be the origin story for every narrative of empire this country tells itself. You know, the genocide of Native Americans, the damming of the Missouri River, not only for hydroelectric power, but to take away sacred agricultural land of the Mandan peoples. I grew up a half hour upstream from where George Armstrong Custer last lived before he went west and had the worst day of his life, you know, and where Sitting Bull surrendered his rifle. You know, I mean, it was a phenomenal place, both in the human stories, but in the grand geologic scale of time, I knew great ice sheets had shaped the land I loved roaming in. And it's where I go back to in my mind whenever I struggle with writing and my senses seem to flow. It is such a wellspring for my creativity. But I grew up with men, as I say in my memoir, who call Oliver County God's country, but they make their money by destroying it. And I thought, if you really love something, why would you have this big thing called a drag line that literally rips away the precious soil? So there's a huge psychological disconnect, because I think as a child, I trusted what adults were supposedly telling me, but found at every turn they were gaslighting me. And I thought, I don't want to have to grow into an adult that has to exist in sort of this psychic break of a state, you know, of saying, this is the way I have to earn my living, by destroying my home. And I think that's why I've done the work that I do, is because I have to believe the people who are so hell-bent on destroying my home, even members of my own family, do not see the prairie the way I see it. And that's the tall order of writing, that I am naive enough to believe if I write the perfect page to describe my prairie, this will stop. So that's sort of the task I've set out for myself.
When we return, Taylor Brorby is forced to choose between the existential crisis of the assaults on nature and on LGBTQ people, while he seeks to reconcile nature, culture, diversity, and belonging. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts. Check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most, and learn about our conferences. That's bioneers.org. Taylor Brorby reached an existential fork in the road. He was forced to choose between the environmental crisis and a crisis of identity. On the one hand, the fossil fuel industry was threatening the actual extinction of human beings and the collapse of the very web of life that sustains humans and all life. On the other hand, the cultural extinction burst against LGBTQ people began to escalate into an authoritarian crusade. Yet that cultural extinction burst was also empowered and amplified by a cynical political agenda, a divide-and-conquer strategy served powerful economic interests in tandem with a Republican Party using anti-democratic schemes in pursuit of raw power for minority rule. North Dakota has been in the vanguard of state governments that by mid-2023 had introduced over 520 anti-LGBTQ bills nationally. Schools and teachers have been forbidden to teach about sexual orientation and gender identity. Books with LGBTQ themes or by gay authors were being banned from libraries, the very kinds of books that had saved Taylor Brorby's life.
I mean, right now I feel like I live in a country where a huge portion of the population doesn't want the person that I am to exist. I know intellectually that's not true. However, it's hard to believe that when you see whole state legislatures, which are supposed to be representing their constituents, passing legislation in horrific ways. You know, it's one thing to say, well, not all North Dakotans feel this way, but when the state is very, very red and passing very horrific laws into existence, it's hard to feel safe in that whole entire state. It's very frustrating to live in this sort of media culture that doesn't hold our politicians to account so that people know it is the tyranny of the minority who are enacting this over many millions of people's lives. We don't have time to continue to battle for me to have access to being married in every state in this country. We already had a civil war over states' rights, you know, and things like this. And so now it's not that those issues aren't important. It's that they should and have been previously settled issues. And we're living in such a environmental pickle right now where we need many rapid solutions to help our literal species exist on the planet, if that's what we want. And there's not enough time to do it all. We're in this time where the issues we face are so desperately important in terms of literal existence that now I have sort of pivoted from, you know, having done a lot of work against the fracking industry and coal mining to saying my job is to now keep queer youth alive. That feels like that shouldn't have to be anyone's job. Queer youth should be growing up in a world that's rich and varied and shows them the magicalness of growing into adulthood. But we are in it right now with libraries being censored, with anti-trans legislation sweeping the country. It's sort of like, look over here at this shiny thing while my left hand does the destroying of other things that are desperately important to life.
Taylor Broerby left North Dakota for Salt Lake City, where he joined the University of Utah's Tanner Humanities Center. There he's pursued his writing, and he speaks regularly around the U.S. about extractive economies, queerness, disability, and climate change. He's been poignantly surprised by the reception to his book Boys and Oil. It comes at a time when men and the concept of masculinity are in crisis. According to the 2023 State of American Men report, 44% of men have had suicidal thoughts, and 60% say, "No one knows me really well." The report found that, quote, "younger men face higher rates of depressive symptoms, suicidal thoughts, and a sense of isolation," unquote.
Some of my favorite letters I've gotten since the book has come out have actually been from straight men who have been shaved down in a particular image their fathers thought they should be, you know, linemen on the football team. This one letter really sticks with me. "Mr. Broerby, I read your book. I'm unfortunately straight and happily married with 3 children, and my misfortune was that I was gifted a large body that my father wanted me to be a lineman on the football team, and I wanted to be an oil painter. And he said, you know, I'm 45 with a broken body, and I no longer paint." And I thought, that's so sad. You know, I mean, we talk about toxic masculinity and living in that culture. And then when you hear from people who are the victims of that, who we might see on the street and go, oh, their life is pretty easy. They're white straight men who fit in and all of this. And then you hear these sort of stories, they really crack open the nut of the issues that we're living in. And I just wanted a book where, you know, little Bobby kept the pistol and the gun safe, and little Susie didn't put the noose around her neck. That felt like a huge responsibility. Going out now and having that book in the world, and you hear, You know, it's only been out for a year, and regularly I will have queer youth come up to me and say, your book kept me alive. And I thought, wow, within the last year you had thought the other option was an option. I mean, we are in a real moment as a society. So I'm aware of that. You know, it's sort of beware of what you wish for. You might get it. And then the bar becomes higher. These queer youth want some assurance that life is worth living. The prairie teaches you that nature thrives in diversity. The prairie is nothing if not an intermingled system of varied and various roots. But I keep thinking about the stories that need to come out from these places. You know that, for instance, Black people have been in North Dakota as long as people who look like me. Exactly. And I can't write a memoir about being Black in North Dakota. And I need those stories. Stories are how we build empathy. It's how I grow for myself to be a better ally and a better caretaker of my own inner landscape, as well as it's not only caretaking of others, but also to be kind to ourselves, because the world tries to whittle us into something that we cannot be. I mean, I grew up in this incredible symphony of sound that nature gave me when, you know, the sounds of the human world were belittling me and beating me into submission. It was this variety of red-winged blackbird and of pheasant clucks, and that the prairie, when it's breezy, literally whispers. And so I learned growing up to listen. And I think whatever those landscapes are, they're whispering to us. And they're telling us what we need to buoy ourselves and to buoy each other. There's a certain gentleness that the land reveals to us if we listen well and listen often. Mm-hmm. Now, I know I wasn't alone in that small place where I felt the only thing keeping me alive and that felt important was I was fortunate to grow up in a landscape big enough to hold what I felt. That we didn't go to therapy, that my therapy was brought to me by the Square Butte Creek and the beautiful cirrus clouds that feathered the sky. It was in relationship with sage grouse that heaved their yolk yellow breasts into the air. It was by hearing beavers slap their tail in the water. And so, as Mary Oliver says, you know, no matter who you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over again, announcing your place in the family of things.
Taylor Rorby, Staying Alive, Reconciling Nature, Culture, and Gay Rights. Executive Producer Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel. Senior Producer and Station Relations Stephanie Welch. Host and Consulting Producer Neil Harvey. Program Engineer and Music Supervisor Emily Harris. Producer Teo Grossman. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 262.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
I'm visiting a friend in Amsterdam. It's a damp squib of a day. My friend suggests the Van Gogh Museum. I say, here we pronounce it Van Gogh. I'm quick to side with my fellow Europeans. It's only 6 months since the Brexit vote. My friend is an American. He insists it's Van Gogh, and I concede to go with Van Gogh. I'm getting in free on my friend's museum pass. My friend is a photographer. He's intrigued by people and the way they photograph things. specifically cool European things. He spent 2 years travelling around the continent capturing tourists as they photographed their companions posing in front of iconic sites. Buckingham Palace gates, the Winter Gardens at Versailles, hands raised like wannabe supermen next to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, clambering over the Parthenon. He has little interest in these famous places. Crumbly buildings are much of a muchness when you travel as much as my friend does. It's the way these strangers see themselves in relation to the buildings which forms the basis of his art. We've picked a good morning for Van Gogh. The museum's hiving with tourists, all but the intensely earnest, those here to actually appreciate art, are clutching smartphones or wear fancy cameras strung like pendants around their necks. To distance ourselves from the Philistines, my friend and I make a complete circuit of the museum, pausing for a discreet 30 seconds in front of each painting. We make appreciative art noises. We pass comment on those pieces we deem especially nice. I watch a man in a fisherman's hat move robot-like around the gallery, raising his iPad in front of each painting to snap a photograph. Snap's the perfect verb for this man. There's something of the turtle about the way his body leans into the art, then suddenly retreats. He doesn't look at Van Gogh directly. He keeps a protective screen between himself and the art. He could just as easily be observing a solar eclipse, indirectly for fear of overexposing his eyes. I point the man out to my friend. There are postcards of all these paintings in the museum shop, he says. Why doesn't the man just buy a box set? I think of myself, aged 6 or 7, using greaseproof paper to trace my favourite toys in the Argos collection. This was the next best thing to ownership. If I traced a Game Boy or etch a sketch, it sort of belonged to me. I have some sympathy for iPad Man. I don't mention this to my friend. My friend stations himself in front of sunflowers. He photographs the tourists taking photos of themselves with the painting, mostly selfies on smartphones. I take pictures of my friend taking pictures. I feel very meta. Like I'm in a hall of mirrors, a kaleidoscope of repeating yellows and flesh tones. Approached like this, Van Gogh's sunflowers doesn't look like itself. I've seen this painting so many times, reproduced on t-shirts and jigsaws. The original seems unreal, and more so when viewed through a tunnel of screens. After a few minutes, we're removed by a security guard. We're told it's okay to take photographs of the paintings, but we can't photograph the people taking pictures of the paintings. My friend says, but I'm making a statement about how contemporary gallery goers interact with art. The guard says, no, you're not. We are not looking at the paintings in the appropriate way. I don't know much about Van Gogh. I've watched one documentary, read a few articles. Still, I'm pretty certain Van Gogh was not a big believer in the appropriate way of looking at things. Do I bring this up? I do not. The security guard has clearly had enough of us. We're escorted out of the museum. I'm a little thrilled by this. Though inappropriate art viewing is hardly an arrestable offence, I've never broken the law before. Except when I stole a teaspoon from Costa Coffee researching a story about kleptomaniacs. Guilt-ridden, I returned the spoon the following day. For once, I feel like a proper artist, sticking it to the man. In the pub afterwards, my friend and I discussed the state of the world, the way real life no longer feels real until it's captured on a smartphone and plastered over social media. People, my friend concludes, have lost the art of being present. They're so intent on recording everything for posterity, they're not actually in the here and now. I agree. I also wonder where this leaves us. I pin everything down with words, and my friend reconfigures the world through his camera lens. It's our way of seeing and understanding. It's how we take ownership. Are we really any different from the selfie-snapping tourists, forcing ourselves into every frame?
I was 9, I had an operation on my eye. It took place under general anaesthetic, and when I came round in the recovery room, I asked the nurse why there was a crow at the end of my bed. She told me to shush, to relax. There was no crow. There was. I'd been watching for ages, the way it perched on the guardrail, watching me, its bright, bright eyes. But as soon as she told me I was seeing things, it vanished. For more than a year, my right eye had been crying constantly, unable to stop. They suspected a blocked tear duct, but in the operating theatre found I'd no tear duct at all and were forced to make one with their needle-fine instruments channeling inside and under my eye. It worked, but my chronic vision problems were just beginning. Soon after, I was told I needed glasses for short-sightedness and astigmatism, and I wept more than a canal's worth of tear ducts could have held. For years, I wore glasses only when I had to, moving through my world the rest of the time in a dreamy haze, spent hours in my bedroom doing exercises which books by American physicians promised would surmount myopia, which was really in the mind. I do think it makes sense that physical symptoms have a mental, an emotional, a spiritual dimension. Louise Hay's book said eye problems signified an inability to see the past, present, or future clearly, or not liking what you saw. Short-sightedness was fear of the future, astigmatism, fear of seeing the self. In a story, I could make easy sense of this, and a neat symbol of the child who can't stop weeping. It's harder in real life. A bright spot was my friend Lisa, who joined my school in sixth form. Lisa was similarly myopic, but didn't mind her glasses. She'd thick, purple, sparkly frames and wore them even on nights out. Lisa took me glasses shopping and we chose frames we decided made me look littery, which I kept for years. I like to think everyone we meet in life, even those who cross our paths just fleetingly, has a gift for us. And I often thank Lisa in my head for what she gave me, the revelation I could be myself, that maybe it was as simple as deciding to decide I liked myself in glasses. But my vision continued to deteriorate until I couldn't read even the first largest letter on the chart, until the contrast between the small rectangle of clear world and the blur around it began to give me bad headaches. Contact lenses helped, but only to a point, and when I was 30, I underwent corrective laser eye surgery. This surgery is carried out not under general anaesthetic, not even sedation, just local anaesthetic drops in the eye. You lie down, your eyelid clamped open by a frame so it can't blink shut. You focus on the green light and try to control your breathing, recite lines of poetry to yourself like mantras, and as you feel your eyes being sliced, have the most curious sensation of being a being inside who merely looks out through these lenses. The saint whose name I share, the patron saint of blind people, sick children, authors, for whom the darkest day of midwinter is marked, is often pictured holding eyeballs on stalks or on a golden platter like grapes. Martyred in 3rd century Sicily, one of the apocryphal stories of St. Lucy is that when a would-be suitor admired her eyes, she plucked them out and sent them to him in an attempt to discourage his unwanted attentions. Imagine what it would be to stiffen your fingers into claws, hook in under your eyelids and yank out your eyes. I don't think I could write that scene in fiction, though I also think when people say, I can't imagine it, they often mean they'd rather not. The failing isn't aesthetic, but of empathy, or is some instinct of self-preservation. There is nothing that we can't, if we try hard enough with our inner vision, see. Salman Rushdie describes the eye he lost to his would-be assassin's knife in grisly detail, lolling on his cheek like a large soft-boiled egg. Though in the account his wife, Rachel Eliza Griffiths, gives, she didn't let him look in the mirror for weeks in case the horror of what he saw impeded his ability to heal. We know this, of course. The great visionaries, the ones who really change our world, see things not as they are, but as they could be. To see has an Indo-European root, meaning to follow, So much of what we see is a consensus reality, and the actual obliterates the possible, and we look to our artists, to our saints, to come at things more fiercely, starkly, strangely, aslant, anew. My own eyes healed successfully, but I've never lost the sense of how miraculous it is to open your eyes and see, nor that other shadow sense of being the being behind, doing the looking, directing the gaze. I saw the crow again, almost 30 years later, when I undertook a series of vision quests with a shamanic practitioner. That's another story, really, but she told me it had been there all along.
Colin, who works in the butcher's, his wife, he is telling the customer in front of me, has had a bad dose of that peekaboo virus. Peekaboo virus? Yep. Ended up in ICU. Colin carries on over the customer's groans, talking about this other person he knows who was in hospital with new pussycat. Anticipating the question, what's new, pussycat? To which the answer is, whoa. That would be lost on anyone who does not remember Tom Jones in his pomp and just about in his extravagantly frilled shirt. I pay for my maple-cured back bacon. The jokes, Colin tells me, are on the house. With the phone on which, up until I walked out the front door 5 minutes before, I was watching Ways of Seeing. Watching specifically Ways of Seeing episode one and pausing at the precise moment 28 minutes and 54 seconds in when John Berger points into the camera out of the screen, out of a converted electrical goods warehouse in early 70s Ealing, as it happens, and after nearly half an hour deconstructing art criticism as it has hitherto been practiced and broadcast, says, "Trust nothing, not even me. You can't reply to me. For that to become possible in the modern era of communication, access to the media must become extended beyond its present narrow limits." So, of course, the below-the-line comments of other people who have been watching Ways of Seeing before me on their phones and tablets are all, "Wow, he's talking about the ability to comment in the modern age, and that's what we're doing right now." Apart from the person who says that she had actually been looking for videos on how to sew and had accidentally hit two E's instead of an EW. The pointing finger singles you out. You, yes you, places you, as psychologists will tell you, under an obligation to respond. John Berger's finger first pointed on the 8th of January 1972. I didn't see it. Match of the day was on the other side. It didn't matter what else was on in those days in our house. The minute match of the day was on, everything else was off. The revolution could, in fact, have been televised, but if it was on BBC Two, like Ways of Seeing, or, God forbid, UTV, we would never have known. But then, who in the revolution would have been able to describe for you Derek Dugan's opening headed goal in Wolves' 3-1 win away to Manchester United? Luckily for me, Top of the Pops was on a Thursday night, and 6th of July in any case fell well after the end of the 1971-72 season. So I did see, 6 months almost to the day after Ways of Seeing episode one, David Bowie as Ziggy Stardust do Starman. Did watch as he sang that he had to phone someone, so he picked on index finger circling, circling, finally pointing at me. He picked on me. And it is true what everybody else who saw it thought that he had singled them out too says. It was as if the phone actually rang in my head. As if, for all that at 10 I already took up a lot of room and made an undue amount of noise, no one had ever noticed me before. I wish I could say it transformed me the way it transformed some of those others, but there were moments in the teen years that followed when I clung to that implied recognition. Don't worry about those looks you're getting. Bowie sees. Bowie knows. All this, I should add, in the far-off days before closed-circuit television. I lived for a time in my early 30s, across the road from a man who I'm going to call Barry. A couple of weeks after we moved in, he and his wife, let her be Brenda, came over for a drink. Quite a few drinks. We would have tried to wind it up much earlier, but our cat had got in through their cat flap the week before and had eaten the chicken they'd left out for their Sunday dinner. So, you know, we owed them. I saw you in town the other day, Barry said. I didn't see you. You wouldn't. He tapped the side of his nose. Barry does the CCTV, Brenda said. The whole city centre. And Barry grinned and said, peekaboo. Which, in this, the week that we mark the anniversary of 1984, still chills me even more than the thought of Big Brother. Outside the butcher's, my phone pings me a belated confirmation of the maple-cured back bacon transaction. And when I swipe that away, there is John Berger, frozen in time, pointing. And there, down the side of the screen, are recommendations that YouTube, which of course has been watching me, watching him, thinks I might like to look at next. More early 70s match of the day highlights. You didn't imagine that I'd actually remembered that Derek Dugan goal, did you? More early 70s match of the day highlights, more Bowie videos, more art history. Surveillance come down off the lamppost and into the palm of my hand. I do what I often do when that realization hits me, try to throw it off, even for a minute. Ways of S-E-W-I-N-G, I type in the space bar. Peekaboo back, YouTube. I see you too.
As I walk up University Avenue in Belfast on a Monday morning, a little girl wearing a light blue rhinestone hijab crosses the street balancing on a scooter. When she reaches the curb several feet ahead of me, she hoists up her mode of transport, sets it back down, and kicks, kicks, kicks the pavement in patterns of three. Her course is a bit wobbly, but sure nonetheless. her puffy pink coat unzipped flaps in the breeze. Her sparkly headscarf reminds me of the hijabs worn by young Somali girls at a school where I worked in Minnesota. She's the same age. I smile to myself and then feel an old ache in my chest. Some teachers used to complain about the Somali kids, remarking how unruly they were. The teachers would say, "This used to be such a nice school," and "We used to have a real neighborhood feel." The outbreak of Somalia's civil war in 1991 led to a major wave of Somali immigration to the United States throughout the 90s, with people seeking refuge from violence, famine, floods, and drought. Minnesota is a state with a history of resettlement programs. It is currently home to the country's largest population of Somali immigrants. Of all the possible paths through places in the world, I wonder what led this little girl to this street, in this city, on this day, and I wonder how she fares. I moved to Belfast about a month ago to study culture, conflict, and change through creative writing. In the weeks before my arrival, I researched rental properties online. Being a single woman, I typed into the search bar, "safest neighborhoods in Belfast," and queried areas to avoid. I consulted with a friend's cousin's daughter and another friend's son's wife. I dedicated my first days in Belfast to walking neighborhoods to get a feel before putting down a deposit. My future home is packed tightly within a long row of red brick terrace houses. On one end of the street sits a newly integrated school. On the other end, only two doors down from mine, is a burned-out house with boarded-up windows and broken glass in the yard. When I hop in a taxi, I ask the driver, "So, what do you think of this area?" He says, "Not for me." My stomach tightens, and I ask him why. He shares that he grew up and still lives on Falls Road. I shuffle through my mental notes and think, wait a minute, I read that Falls Road was a dangerous part of town. He says that his father was shot and killed in '87 by loyalists. Jesus, I say out loud, and immediately wish I hadn't. They busted the door down and shot his father right there in his bed. There was nothing more to say as we drove north on Woodstock Road, passing a mural on the side of a building with machine guns and the words, "Never forget." Later that day, I stand at the end of my block by the school and look down the street. I question whether this is, in fact, a bad part of town. When a woman in her 50s emerges from the school's yard, I say, "Excuse me, I'm looking to maybe live here. What do you think of this area?" She tells me she's lived here for 30 years and everyone is friendly. She says I'll know the shopkeepers' names in no time, and I recall the quaint Italian market on the corner, the fruit shop down the street. I walk to the other end of my block and stand next to the boarded-up house. Another woman, younger, comes along walking a dog. I say, "Excuse me, I'm new here. What do you think of this area? Do you feel safe walking around at night?" She confirms she generally does, but shrugs her shoulders when she adds, "But you know, the demographics are changing." By the time I encounter the little girl on her scooter, I no longer ask people for their opinion of this area or that. The girl stops in front of me mid-pavement and adjusts the crown of her hijab, tucking the fabric along her neck more tightly into the collar of her sweater. She looks up. I wonder what she looks at and look up too, but see nothing unusual. I pass her. When I'm several paces ahead, I pause and turn around. Her gaze is still fixed above. I ask, "What are you noticing?" She says, "The clouds." I look up again. We watch a group of clouds drift across a crisp blue sky. She says, "They're moving fast, and they're not supposed to move so fast, that lot." I'm taken aback by a Somali-looking girl with an Irish way of speaking. I hadn't realized I expected her to sound like a child in Minnesota. I say, "They are moving kind of fast, and must be a breeze up there pushing them along." She agrees. We look at each other then and smile. I continue walking. She kicks, 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 and catches up with me, passes, circles around, and returns back my direction. We smile once more as she rolls by. I continue walking up University Avenue, and for a moment, feel at home.
Sometimes we have to leave home to find a way of seeing it. We're going to sing a melody that has been sung and played for centuries in this part of the world. In the 18th century, it was known as the Merry Month of May or the Nightingale. And in the 1950s, a writer by the name of Dominic Behan set his own text to it and called it the Patriot Game. That song was taken up by the Clancy Brothers, who stormed America, sang it in Carnegie Hall, and a wee fella called Bobby Dylan heard it, and he did his own thing with the very same melody and wrote an anti-war song called God on Our Side. And just before as we were writing our first album, No Fixed Abode, we wanted to do our thing with this incredible melody. So this is Rebel Song. And we'd like to dedicate this to the people of Palestine. Oh, my name it is nothing, my age it means less. The country I come from is caught in distress. Its name is disputed, it depends when you've cried, while the smoke at the border blows.
Child, my own sweet little Artemis, my infant cosmonaut, when I saw you for the first time, you were rising out of the blue, a heartbeat across the carmine line of my womb. There you were, feisty and daring, tethered in your own universe, a frontier beyond the images beamed back, grainy, lunar, spectral. Like a vision on a screen I'd seen before all those decades earlier.
You've been listening to Sunday Miscellany, Ways of Seeing, recorded in the Crescent Arts Centre in Belfast and first broadcast last year as part of Belfast Book Festival. The scripts were Sunflowers by Jan Carson, Seeing Things by Lucy Caldwell, Ways of Seeing, Peekaboo was by Glenn Patterson, A Street in Belfast by Emily Byers Ferrian, and Child, a poem by Maria McManus. The music was Little Sunflower by Freddie Hubbard, played by Scott Flanagan on keyboard. A Set of Jigs, played by Sinead McKenna on fiddle and Mickey Fearon on guitar. The More I See You by Brad Meldo, also played on keyboard by Scott Flanagan. Rebel Song, performed by True, who are Donal Kearney, Zach Troughton, and Michael Mormicha. And a hornpipe.